It's the 20th of September 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. What next for the Kepler Space Telescope? Is David Attenborough at risk of squandering his national treasure status in the 87th minute? Are we living in an era of post-truth politics, or am I just making that up? And why is Leila Johnson definitely not doing the time warp again? But before we begin the traditional begging slot, if you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All the donations help us pay the server bills and that sort of thing. Also, I'm currently looking for a job, so if you'd like to employ me, head over to our website and follow links to my CV, where you can find out what I'm good at. I'd really like to, you know, write or make podcasts for some sort of media thing, maybe? I don't know. Get in touch if that's the case. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, we start this week in space, where NASA's Kepler Space Telescope has recently entered retirement. That's right, it's putting on its space slippers and is complaining loudly about how that Andromeda has really lowered the tone of the galactic neighbourhood. Back on Earth, meanwhile, NASA scientists have been trying to figure out if poor old Kepler is up to doing any more science, or whether it would just be kinder to kill it off. To find out more, Kash Farouk has been speaking to Dr. John Jenkins, who's the lead analyst on Kepler, to, I guess, analyse the situation.
A few months ago, I interviewed the SkyNet's Chris North to discuss the European Space Agency's Herschel Space Telescope, which was about to be retired as it had run out of the coolant it needed to operate. Now it's NASA's turn. The Kepler Space Telescope is to be retired. Or perhaps it won't. I spoke to one of the Kepler team, Dr. John Jenkins, about the spacecraft. I began by asking him to introduce himself and to describe his role on the team.
I'm John Jenkins, the analysis lead for the Kepler mission. I work for the SETI Institute at NASA Ames Research Center. And my job is to build the software pipeline that processes the science data, taking us from the pixels that come down from the spacecraft to the planet candidates that come out the pipeline.
Okay, great. You've briefly touched on it there, but can you give an overview of Kepler, sort of what it is, what its objectives were, and how long it's been running, things like that?
Absolutely. So Kepler is NASA's first mission capable of finding Earth-sized planets orbiting other stars like the Sun. And it was launched in March of 2009 to search for transiting planets, planets that cross the face of their star as viewed by the spacecraft. And so we're interested in observing these transits. And because we're interested in planets like Earth, that means that we need to observe for several years so that we see several instances when the planet crosses in front of the face of its star. Now, the probability that a planet will cross the face of its star from our point of view is very small. The orbit of the planet has to be edge-on from our point of view, otherwise the planet never crosses the face of its star. And that's one reason why Kepler observes over 150,000 stars, because this probability of the geometric alignment is so small. We need to look at large numbers of stars in order to be certain that if planets like Earth are common, that we'll see a sufficient number of them over the course of the mission.
Okay, and the technology is so finely tuned that you can detect just the slight dip in the light.
Yes, it is, and it's a very small signature. From the ground, people have been able to detect planets similar in size to Jupiter, and Jupiter is about 10 times the diameter of the Earth, and so it's a little over 100 times bigger by area. And what we sense when we make a transit measurement is the difference in the area, or the ratio of the area of the planet to the area of the star. And planets like the Earth are about 100 times smaller than the Sun by radius. So that means we're talking about a 1 part in 10,000 drop in brightness, or a percent of a percent. And so that's a very minuscule signal, and it means that we have to be able to make very precise measurements of the change in brightness of a star over several hours to a couple of days in order to be able to make this measurement.
Okay, so one of the key components of the spacecraft are these gyroscopes, and can you tell me what they're needed for and basically what's happened to them?
Yes, so in order to make these very precise measurements, we need extremely precise pointing. So for Kepler, that was delivered by these devices called reaction wheels, which are similar to gyroscopes, but they're used actually to control the pointing of the spacecraft very, very precisely. So for example, we were able to control the pointing of the spacecraft to 0.01 arc seconds On timescales of 15 minutes and longer. And 0.01 arcseconds is very small. An arcsecond is 1/60th of an arc minute, which is 1/60th of a degree. So this is a very small change in the angle that we were able to control to. And in order for us to be able to point the spacecraft, we need at least three of these reaction wheels running at any given time. And we were launched with four. Unfortunately, we lost the first of the four a year ago in June of 2012. And then we lost a second reaction wheel in May of this year. So what that means is that we're no longer able to control our pointing to this very tight precision while we're observing the Kepler target stars.
Okay, so moving on to what's going to happen next to Kepler. So this interview was delayed for a couple of weeks as you've been really busy reviewing white papers with ideas for repurposing Kepler. So can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so NASA asked us to put out a call for ideas about what we could do with the Kepler spacecraft now that we're unable to continue our primary mission. And so we collected 42 such proposals, and we spent the last several weeks basically reviewing the technical aspects of each of these proposals and also reviewing the merit of the science goals that were proposed in each of these white papers. And so we're wrapping that up. In fact, today we're conducting a final review of the results out of the technical review and out of the science review for the purposes of putting together a proposal that we'll send to NASA headquarters with the strongest science cases that we can muster out of this process, together with our ideas about the technical feasibility and what the quality of the science is that we're likely to get back from it. So we did receive a wide variety of white papers that proposed, for example, that we observe some of the planets in our own solar system and that we would go on and observe for or look for near-Earth objects. But because this is an astrophysics mission, we focused on the astrophysics cases like exoplanets. So several of these white papers proposed that we look for the smallest exoplanets around the smallest stars around the ecliptic plane. And so the orbital plane of the spacecraft is very similar to the orbital plane of the Earth, and that's called the ecliptic. And it turns out that the Ball engineers have come up with a way of operating the spacecraft that we believe will deliver very stable pointing, albeit not as good as we had with Kepler. And the wrinkle is that we won't be able to use this method in the Kepler field of view. At least it won't work out quite as well there. So if we observe a field of view that is in the ecliptic plane along the direction that the spacecraft is moving in, then we believe that we can keep the spacecraft pointed and very stably pointed over periods of up to about 3 months or so. And we'll have to occasionally adjust the attitude of the spacecraft because the solar pressure will tend to rotate it in a way that we don't like. But every 3 or 4 days, we can reset it and basically keep the stars on the same pixels, much in the way that we kept the stars on the same pixels while we were observing the Kepler field of view. And the problem with the Kepler field of view is that once a day we would have to rotate the spacecraft by 1 degree. And this doesn't sound like a lot, but it means that the stars would move to entirely new pixels, and we feel that that change in where the stars would end up on the sensors will perturb the quality of the data, so we wouldn't be able to get as good a science result out of those observations. Whereas if we're observing a field in the ecliptic for 3 months or so, then we can look for small rocky planets around small M and K stars where you have much smaller habitable zones. And so you can actually observe and detect planets in the habitable zone of these small stars if we observe in the ecliptic. So the final decision hasn't been made as to what we'll actually do. But I think that one of the main goals that we'll have coming out of this process will be a survey of M and K stars, which are smaller than the Sun, to look for planets in the habitable zone of those stars in fields around the ecliptic plane. We're very excited about the panoply of science that we can do with Kepler in this repurposed mission.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound like it has to be retired then.
No, I don't believe so. We estimate that in this new mode of operation, we could observe for between another two and another 4 years. So that would be equivalent to the primary mission if we reached the 4-year mark.
Okay, so moving on to what Kepler has achieved already. Firstly, how many confirmed planets are there so far?
There are about 140 confirmed planets. I'm sure we'll have many more than that by the time this is all over and done with. It turns out that it's a lot easier to find the planetary signatures in the Kepler data than it has been to get enough telescope time from the ground to actually follow up and confirm these candidates.
Right, okay, yeah, so once you start with a candidate and then you have to do other observations to make it a confirmed planet, so, and that's using different technologies?
That's correct, and it depends a lot on what kind of star we're talking about and how big the planet is. So, for example, planets that are, say, Neptune size and larger often are massive enough that we can make radial velocity observations from the ground with the Keck telescope, for example, to directly measure the mass of the planet and confirm that it's really a planet. And when you're able to do that, you get, if you have the mass from a radial velocity measurement and you have the size from the transit measurement, that gives you the bulk density of the planet. And that's very exciting because now you can start asking the question, what is this thing made of? We did use this methodology with Kepler-10b, which is the first unquestionably rocky planet that was discovered. It's about 1.4 Earth radii. It's in a 20-hour orbit of its star, which means it's scorching hot. So it may have an ocean of lava on the side that's facing the star. But it's unquestionably rocky, and that's because we made these measurements with the Keck telescope showing that it's 4.6 Earth masses together with its size that gives you about 9 grams per cubic centimeter, and that secures it as a rocky planet.
Okay, and to wrap up, are there any sort of particular key discoveries that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think one of the most exciting things about Kepler has been the statistics. So while we have 140 or so confirmed or validated planets, we have over 3,500 planet candidates, and that's allowing us to get the answers to the question, how frequent are Earth-sized planets around Sun-like stars? And so what we hope to do with the 4 years of data that we have in hand is completely mine it, get all the science out so that we can answer the question with regards to Sun-like stars, G stars like the Sun. At the moment now, we have pretty good answers for the smallest stars in our survey, the M stars, but we need to press forward to fully analyze the data. And at the moment, we only have the first 2 years fully analyzed, and we're working on analyzing the first 3 years of data at the moment. So there's a lot more to come from Kepler, both from the primary mission as well as the repurposed mission. So stay tuned for new news from Kepler.
Okay, that's all my questions. Dr. John Jenkins, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Cash. It's been my pleasure.
Now this week, National Treasurer and friend of the show, Sir David Attenborough, caused some controversy when the 87-year-old said something that sounds a bit dodgy when talking about foreigners. Sir David is a big believer in population control, the idea that there's just too many of us, so we should look into controlling the human population. But is he right? Lucy Abel thinks he's talking rubbish, which presumably puts her on top of the endangered species list if Attenborough does ever seize control. Here's Lucy explaining more.
Earlier this week, David Attenborough gave an interview to The Telegraph, in which he claimed that unless we reduce the world's population, malnutrition is inevitable, and that sending food aid to countries suffering famine crises is, to quote directly, balmy. By a helpful twist of fate, the day David Attenborough decided to once again share his views on population growth was also the midpoint of the International Congress of Nutrition, which is where I am at the moment. Taking place every 4 years, the conference brings together over 4,000 nutrition researchers from around the world to discuss everything from food policy to nutrigenomics to agriculture. It's big and noisy, and there's free ice cream. It's a pretty amazing place to be. Over the last 5 days, I've listened to world experts in malnutrition argue about what we can do for the billions of people who don't have enough to eat. They've discussed malnutrition's effects on individuals and impact on society, the role of governments, and the varying successes of the many interventions being trialled around the world. Into this mix weighed Sir David Attenborough, arguing that population growth is the cause of famine and malnutrition, and that population control will solve it. He's come out with the plague of humanity idea before, and it's a popular view. Surely less people means more food. Isn't it our own fault if we don't have enough to eat? Should we really be sending emergency rations to sustain populations in areas that seem unable to produce enough for themselves? Are there not parts of the world we just shouldn't inhabit? I'll come back to that last point in a moment, but to address whether population control would solve, for example, famine in sub-Saharan Africa, well, I'm afraid that, unfortunately, inevitably, It's not quite that simple. The fact is that while rapid population growth can exacerbate famine and malnutrition, it is not the only or even the main cause. Ethiopia, to use Attenborough's own example, is trapped in a cycle where extreme rural poverty and crippling national debt means there is little investment to improve agricultural productivity, in turn begetting further poverty. The International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, describes the situation as the lack of improved agricultural production technologies and land use planning has combined with deforestation, perceived land tenure insecurity, soil erosion, overgrazing, drought, and population pressure to contribute to severe environmental deterioration. To break this vicious cycle, there is an urgent need to integrate sustainable agricultural and land management practices into farming systems. In other words, it's complicated, and restricting population growth really won't solve that many problems. To take Attenborough's other point, that sending in sacks of flour is not the way to solve the world hunger crisis, yes, he's absolutely right, which is why it is a crisis response and not a long-term solution. We need, and are working towards, sustainable alternatives. This week, for example, I heard how IFAD is trying to change the way crop value is perceived, from a purely financial model to something that reflects the nutritional value of the crop, a practice called nutrition-sensitive agriculture. It is hoped that building policy around this idea will encourage, for example, the production of secondary crops grown on the borders of farmed land specifically for periods of hunger, rather than diverting all resources into crops that will sell for the highest price, regardless of their nutritional value and potential to alleviate malnutrition. So work is being done. It has a long way to go, but the will is there. It's not surprising Attenborough doesn't know about it, it's not very well advertised. What is surprising, perhaps, is his objection to emergency food aid. I hope he simply got confused and was objecting to some constructed idea where all we're doing for malnutrition is sending bags of flour. Because to suggest that we don't provide aid in times of crisis, that we just leave the problem to resolve itself as some sort of revenge of the natural world, displays an unpleasant lack of empathy that sits uncomfortably alongside his self-identification as a humanist. So the solution isn't bags of flour, but neither is it forced population control, which doesn't seem to be playing out well in China, what with the trauma surrounding alleged forced abortion, infanticide, and illegal children. Attenborough does at least seem to recognise that himself, as a wealthy European, suggesting African families should have less children, is perhaps not entirely appropriate, to put it politely. It seems we can only keep doing what we're doing, investing in techniques and programs to improve agricultural productivity, education, and yes, family planning. There is a lot more going on than I have mentioned, and you can find a link to IFAD's work in Ethiopia in the follow-up links. Rapid population growth does put pressure on already food insecure populations, but that is not an excuse not to help or to give up. We need positive action, not negative whining about how awful human existence is. I think what disappoints me most about hearing these statements from a hero of mine is that they show such a depressing lack of imagination. Right now, 4,000 experts in nutrition are coming to the end of a week filled with opportunity and driven by the desire to change things. The dedication to improving global nutrition I saw in every speaker, panel, and delegate was inspiring. David Attenborough himself has inspired millions throughout his career. And with his extensive involvement in wildlife conservation, it's a shame he doesn't bring that passion for the natural world to human problems as well. This is Lucy Abel, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Now, you don't have to look too far to find evidence that we're living in an era of post-truth politics, which is basically a euphemism for just making things up. This week, Mark Thompson has been up at Lib Dem conference and has been talking to Alex Marsh to talk about this phenomenon in more detail.
So I'm joined by Alex Marsh, who is a Lib Dem blogger, but also is a lecturer in policy studies. The reason I wanted to talk to Alex today is Alex did a blog post last year, so in September 2012, called On Post-Truth Politics, which is a term that I hadn't heard before, but apparently has been coined fairly recently. Alex, do you just want to define what you see as post-truth politics?
So it seems to me that it moves us beyond the notion of spinning and giving a slant on things into a situation where politicians are willing to offer interpretations of events that have come, if you like, uncoupled from statistical evidence or agreed interpretations. So in some senses it can cover, I guess, a number of practices, but there is an element of degree, and I think that the view would be that whereas, you know, we've had spin around for a while, we've had people spinning as hard as they can to give their most positive and optimistic perspective on policy events and, if you like, the consequences of policy, that there's a strand in that which is saying, well, actually, we're going beyond that to asserting things about the nature of the world, be it, you know, climate change or, you know, the state of unemployment statistics or, you know, the sorts of policy changes that your opponents are proposing and their consequences that actually don't really stand up to very robust scrutiny.
Do you mean can be proven wrong pretty much with a 5-minute trawl of some actual statistics?
In some cases, I think that's right. Yes, in some cases you can say, well, actually, that's rather different. But then on the other hand, it can be something a bit more. You get into some sort of grey areas. I think a good example of that is something about the debate about what's happening with jobs in the UK is quite an interesting one, because there are some big numbers mentioned about jobs created. Now, that might well be sort of technically true, but equally it doesn't take long to say, well, actually, the numbers banded around a million plus include all sorts of things, like, you know, workfare placements. They include reclassifications from public to private sector. You know, is that a job created or is it not? Yeah, so is it, I mean, it's a spin on what's going on. Is it true, is it not? Well, you can quite easily unpick it and find out what lies behind it. Is that entirely post, well, that, I think that's in a grey area between giving the most optimistic and positive interpretation of what's going on and something which is sort of outright incorrect. I just got interested in the idea of post-truth politics, or at least it first came to my attention around the Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Bill, when that came out, and the debate around squatting, because the case was made that we need to criminalise squatting. The legal community, particularly the housing legal community, already pointed out that you know, squatting a residential property which is occupied is already illegal. What wasn't illegal at the time is squatting an empty building, and the government kept conflating the distinction between the two, and every time there was a corrective statement issued by the lawyer, said, well, hang on a minute, you're talking about making something illegal which is already illegal. It almost had no purchase on the nature of the debate, and the housing minister at the time kept sort of reasserting that we need to criminalise this, and it doesn't matter how many times the lawyer said it's already criminal.
And I noticed an element of this in the run-up to the AV referendum, which, cards on the table, I still feel quite bruised about. I wasn't a formal part of the campaign, but I was certainly a pretty heavily involved informal part of the campaign. And I remember in the run-up to it, there was an article published by David Cameron where he was basically having a go at PR and proportional representation. And the amount of times that I had to keep telling people AV is not proportional, and things just seem to get mixed up all the time. And at first, you know, I consider myself to be fairly generous when it comes to political debate, and I will, you know, I will listen to the other person's side. But after the 10th or 15th or 20th time when you've debated with the same person and they're clearly just ignoring what you've said, then in the end I stopped being so generous, because I realised that what they were doing was deliberately ignoring what were facts in this debate. Yes. Because it didn't suit them. Yes. And is that the sort of thing you're talking
Absolutely.
About?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a good example. I mean, certainly I went to a number of AV events locally where there were a number of statements that were flat out wrong about the way AV would operate, simply as an arithmetic sort of nature. And they go, well, this is clearly going to let in much more extremist parties of the right, where we go, well, actually, that's it can't really work like that very easily. Yes, and it didn't matter. I mean, it's that imperviousness to correction,
yeah,
I think, is the issue. That I think that's what's changed. I mean, you know, some people say, well, in the old days, you know, if you're caught misleading the house, you know, you have to, it's a resigning issue. You know, now it's just you sort of go, oh, well, you know, and carry on. And you can get a letter from the Office of National Statistics saying, well, hang on a minute, the way you're interpreting these statistics is rather, there's no evidence that that's the case. I mean, Ian Duncan Smith has had several of those letters, you know, saying, well, actually, hang on a minute, you know, you can't really, you know, the numbers may have changed like that, but you can't really claim that that's attributable to the policy changes that you've made for all sorts of reasons. You know, the causal mechanisms aren't there, the timescale's not right, whatever it might be. And yet, it doesn't really stop a further incident of the same sort of practice. And it's interesting to think, well, why is it that that's the case? I mean, I think one thing I said a while ago was that you know, the existence and expansion of the sort of fact-checking industry, you know, is almost a symptom of the problem. If you didn't start from the presumption that there's a very good chance that what you're being presented with is inaccurate, at the very least, and possibly erroneous, then you wouldn't need a sort of fact-checking industry to go around just trying to work out what exactly it is we're being offered and whether or not it bears any relation to any sort of robust analysis.
Well, one of the things that I found a bit worrying about the blog post that I referred to at the start that you wrote is that you talked, I think you were writing it at the time of the presidential elections, and you mentioned about Paul Ryan, who was the Republican vice presidential candidate, who seemed to me to be almost fetishizing being wrong about stuff, almost being unashamedly wrong about stuff. And there was something that one of Mitt Romney's campaign managers said about these fact-checking organisations that basically seem to be implying or even explicitly stating that they are biased. Mm. They are biased against the Republicans, yeah, in some way, even though those organisations are trying to be equal. And another thing that you raised in the post is, what do you, as a fact-checking organisation, what are you supposed to do if one side is blatantly lying about stuff and the other side is actually being quite reasonable? How can you be balanced in that situation?
I think the jumping-off point for that post was Ryan being caught out suggesting he'd run a marathon in under 3 hours or something, and then it was quite easy to check that. You just have to scan the results and it's clear that he wasn't. Politically, I mean, in America, you know, it seems to me that finishing a marathon is a key requirement for high office, you know, George Bush, you know, whatever it might be, for some reason.
But it sounds like it might be trivial, but Jeffrey Archer started out lying about things like, you know, athletic stuff that he'd done, absolutely. And look where that led in the end.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. No, I mean, in the context, it's important. But it's an odd thing to risk getting caught out on, because actually it's not a difficult thing to check. I mean, I think the Romney, I can't quite remember exactly now, this was a while ago, but it was something like suggesting, well, you know, our version of reality is the one we want to work with, and if a fact check organisation comes up with something that says, well, actually that bears no relation to anybody else's, you know, understanding of what's going on, we're not going to let that stop us. You know, it's almost like we're going to impose our will on the world, and this is how we want it to be, and, you know, the facts can sort of put them to one side as being irrelevant.
It almost feels like Homer Simpson's quote of, you know, you can prove anything with facts, can't you? It's like, you know.
Yes. Yeah, well, absolutely. I think one of the challenges is, going back to your point about the sort of balance, I mean, that's a real challenge for the media, you know, generally. I mean, I think in America there's been a bit of discussion in the about, you know, like media practices, where, you know, there's this notion that you have to be balanced, you've got to put both sides of the debate. And you know, what do you do when it's fairly apparent that one side is talking complete and utter nonsense? And how does the media sort of call that out without, if you like, then confirming, if you like, the sorts of accusations that they are biased, you know? So it's quite an interesting one, and trace it through a little bit. It's clearly people trying to sort of tentatively raise this and sort of raising it through a third person. So rather than an interviewer saying to a politician, you know, I think you're lying, you know, you've got to bring in a sort of third person opinion. Your fact check says this, that and the other, you know, how do you respond to this suggestion that what you're talking about is absolutely not the case? Then you get politicians saying, well, views differ, or, you know, we might interpret these things, or, you know, clearly that's one way of reading it, but we're reading it this way. And you think, well, actually, no, that's not quite the same thing. This goes back to that Daniel Moynihan, you know, saying, you know, we're all entitled to our own opinion, but we're not entitled to our own facts. You know, at some point, it's not just about interpretation.
You referred, obviously, to Paul Ryan and to Mitt Romney in your piece last year. I've always kind of had the feeling that in some areas, at least, the Americans are maybe 5 or 10 years ahead of where we are, and we tend to follow where they go. Now, I'm always wary of glib comparisons between the US and the UK, especially when it comes to politics, because our systems are quite different, but are you worried that it's going to get worse and we're going to find ourselves perhaps in maybe a more polarised situation like they have in the US, where you've got your Fox News, you've got your MSNBC, and you have people who never watch anything but Fox News, and so the perception of reality is just so different to what the actual reality is? And do you think there's any danger that that's starting to happen here, and that maybe that's why people like Grant Shapps and IDS are playing this game, because they think they can get away with it, because they've seen how it can work in other places like the US, and it almost by will they're going to make it happen like that, in conjunction with the way the media landscape is changing?
Clearly the way the media is evolving, the way in which social media and things leads to people if you like, selecting into channels that if you like, accord with their views of the world, you know, perhaps even more so than when we relied on a more mainstream, you know, media, which at least attempted to provide a range of views. I think that is a real risk. I think one of the interesting things for me is that the current coalition government sort of stance on some of these things, a bit like New Labour, hasn't generated sort of outrage that this is somehow ethically inappropriate. So that would, you might say, encourage people. So, you know, what have been the sanctions? What have been what have been the consequences for the politicians of being caught? You know, pretty limited, really.
Pretty much nothing.
Exactly. So you know, IDS, it's not the fact that you misled people about the stats; it's the fact that the universal credit is going to keel over and fail to deliver. That's likely to be the consequence. You know, so I think that without any great downside for them, what's the barrier to it happening further? What's the barrier to it becoming more entrenched? I mean, you know, it seems to me the only likely barrier is if someone outside the political system says, hang on a minute, you know, this is just not sensible. You know, this is not the way we want. This is too important, you know, or too significant, or some of these things you're trying to wrestle with, you know, need to be conducted in a rather more even-handed fashion. But how you get back, how you wind back, if you like, from a trend that's been running, as you say, for 20 years with New Labour, and it's not entirely clear to me how we break out of a cycle which seems to be moving in a particular sort of direction.
Alex Mosh, thank you very much.
Now, time capsules are mostly modern phenomena, apart from that time the Tudors left us Richard III to dig up, which was nice of them. They're only harmless fun, aren't they, time capsules? In this next report, Layla Johnston has been digging up all of the dirt to explain why not.
My name's Layla Johnston, I'm a journalist and maker, and I'm interested in the cultural response to technology. I write about hacking for Wired UK, I've written 3 humour books, and I'm the founder of Hack Circus, a new magazine and event series for makers, players and explorers, all about pushing ideas to fun and fantastical extremes. The first Hack Circus event takes place in London on the 6th of October and is all themed on time and time travel. Check out hackcircus.com for details. And today I want to talk about time capsules. I hate time capsules. I hate thinking about the rubbish that's inside them. I hate that the Blue Peter garden is full of them. And I hate the thought there might be one under my feet, all curling yellow newspaper and rubbish children's drawings of flying cars whenever I'm enjoying an otherwise uneventful walk in the park. They lurk, these rusty biscuit tin landmines full of obsolete currency, commemorative royal memorabilia, and an inflated sense of self-importance. Time capsules are a convenient way of getting rid of rubbish without technically throwing it away. They're a form of dispersed landfill. The future of rubbish is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. But time capsules are just the beginning. I'm concerned that our short-term thinking is making us masters of sentimental landfill on a much bigger scale. There was a madness in the air around the year 2000. It's a madness that happens when the anticipation of a date is allowed to escalate beyond reason over a period of decades, such that the date becomes an occasion. And it's indicative of a lethal passivity. The anticipation that things will change automatically as a result of us moving into a prescribed future rather than taking action ourselves. I believe that everyone was at risk of succumbing to millennium fever because all of us alive today grew up feeling on some level like we were on the brink of something. However, the fever was particularly potent among the young. The millennium was an event for people who got excited about indie music, Will Smith, design, modern architecture, the internet, the X-Files, the future. And I turned 21 in the year 2000. For my generation, it felt personal. It felt as though it was just too much of a coincidence that civilization was coming of age at the same time I was. We felt even more special than all the other young people from every other point in history who felt special. Unlike them, we were different. When our personal timelines collide with a landmark on the timeline of civilization, there is a magnification effect on our own lives. The tour bus suddenly passes through an establishment that was always there, paradoxically both older than us and yet to begin. And we feel ourselves implicated in its strange timelessness and infected by its importance. We feel important enough that we deserve to make our own marks. And what we've ended up with is a sort of memorial graffiti. Such was our investment in the idea of the millennium. Such a byword for optimism had it become. that we built permanent memorials to it, as the Millennium Gallery in Sheffield, the Millennium Bridge in London, the Millennium Bridge in Gateshead, and the notorious Millennium Dome. Cardiff is a Y2K hotspot with the Millennium Stadium and the Millennium Arts Centre. There are a number of footpaths called Millennium Way. Kew has a Millennium Seed Bank, and Han Solo piloted a Millennium Falcon. Nothing is named after the Millennium anymore. In 2013, these aren't memorials to the year 2000, but time capsules. They commemorate not the Millennium, but what I'd call prospective heritage. They're guesses about what will hold significance to imaginary future people, modelled entirely on what holds significance to the creators in the present. In other words, they're a snapshot of our imagined future attitude to significance. I use the Millennium as an example because it has been so quickly forgotten, while all the things named in its honour embarrassingly persist. Its many memorials catch our naivety in thinking people in the year 2013, 2009, or even 2001 would feel any of our pre-millennial wonder about the year 2000 at all. However, there is a sort of charm in these things, their optimism, their naivety, the way they're hanging in there, still going on about the millennium after all these years. They're like photos of us as teenagers, and I feel we need to meditate on this time in our recent past rather than pretend it never happened, in order to realise where we are and where we are not today. The future heritage industry is one of speculation. We know what we think is important now, but it doesn't follow that our future selves will appreciate our insights, not because we're wrong, but because our understanding of the future is so unavoidably filtered by the part of us that always persists in someone else's past. A time capsule doesn't have to acknowledge that our impact, our reception, is to some extent out of our hands. Cultural heritage cannot be speculated, sometimes, maybe even usually, is a one-way street. We are always in the dark to the extent that we are always in the past. And in this respect, any possibility of rational projection is prohibited by the future's delicious contrast to our own situation. From our perspective, the future isn't logically condemned as we are to trailing, but offers an irresistible opportunity for projections of imagination and hope. Ironically, if the future were more directly controllable, we wouldn't feel the weight of it bearing on us like a blank piece of paper, and we wouldn't feel the need to beam our hopes onto it. And the fact is, of course, the future will be shaped by our actions now. However often, I'm arguing too often, thoughts of realistic futures are supplanted by our overwhelming need right now to always wish for the best. This is a quote from a friend of mine. I remember when I was probably 5 years old, everyone in the village gathered round to watch a tree being planted to mark some big occasion. Now most of those people are dead. No one will remember what the occasion was, and fuck knows where the tree is, even if it still exists. Probably part of some overgrown hedge. At the time, everyone would have thought the tree would be looked at in awe by generations to come. These monuments are, as a previous friend pointed out, child actors, when they really should have been superstars. Monuments for future people, time capsules, are myopic and disingenuous. They are there like funerals, designed for the living, not for those on either side of that threshold. However, when people are asked to build something without thinking about the present moment, while focusing quite deliberately on that part of us that is always historical, from the perspective of future beings whose minds we can't even begin to imagine, when people dwell on the bare fact that we are always in someone else's past, the results can be quite amazingly beautiful. This is the 10,000-year clock currently being built in a mountain in Texas by the Long Now Foundation. It differs from time capsules because it draws a parallel between us as creatures existing in someone's past and influences from our own past. It doesn't say, as the millennial monuments do, let's speculate on how we are a bit like from the future, or let's try and push our values about the future onto generations to come. It says, let's acknowledge that we are not the end of this line, and really, the only rule of time, the things that we do now will affect how things turn out. Why does it matter then that we acknowledge we exist in someone else's past? Well, I asked Nick Pope about the millennium. No one knows millennial madness like Nick. He was put in charge of the unexplained reports at the Ministry of Defence in the late 90s, and when he left in 2006, he announced, "The X-Files have been closed down." He is the real Fox Mulder, and he turns up regularly on any news item about strange phenomena. He had this to say about the millennium. "After the moon landings, we believe we'd be holidaying on the moon by the year 2000. The media deceives, though, and progress is often slower than we think. We romanticise the past, look forward to significant dates in the future, and dismiss the present. So why does it matter that we acknowledge we exist in someone else's past? Well, it matters because the most interesting future isn't the collage of sci-fi archetypes, but the banal one, the one that will happen anyway. And it matters because ignoring the possibility that we might be first movers on future events cheats us out of a different kind of excitement, the thrill of knowing we'll never know the 10th, 50th, 1000th move, but that they will happen. When we talk about living in the future as we love to in this post-millennial world, we reject the possibility of an incremental future taking root in the present as we speak. It is hell, it is AI, but it's also the inevitable everyday reality of in-flight meals on outer space travel. One day, all this ordinary stuff will happen, and it would seem extraordinary to us were we to see it, but we must accept it's okay for us not to be there, and for us to never know about it. Our fantasies and the pressure of a blank page are getting in the way of our humility, and our humility is what enables us to be content with the reality of the present. We have to get over ourselves. My concern is that in our determination that things are at their most exciting right now, we not only embarrass our near future selves, we do ourselves out of the real joy of the present as the beginning of something. We need to reconnect with the responsibility and privilege of being someone else's history, of not knowing and of having no idea where our ripples will end. Which is where we went wrong with the millennium, and where we are still going wrong. As we moved forward in time, we dragged the sense of future back towards us until it smothered the present completely. It may not be as glamorous, it may not travel by flying car, but for better or worse, the present is smothered and it needs reviving. It can feel as though the present is the one thing that is intolerable to look at directly, but we must find a way to interpret it by digging up our time capsules and looking again at those fantasies. If we can accept a world beyond our direct influence and desires, then we can have some knowledge of a future and a past, because both are traced on us already. But where this knowledge will prove most useful is in helping us to examine the present, which is where our uncertainty must begin and end, and which is, after all we have.
Now, how does taste work? Shel Grayson recently spoke to the London Skeptics Group about this and has kindly cooked up this next report.
My name is Michelle Grayson, and I'm Senior Editor at Nature working on the supplements programme. Last year, I did an outlook on taste, and this got me really interested in the subject. For a start, there are some common misconceptions about taste. Over and above the sense of taste itself, there are independent but related senses of smell and touch, that is, texture, that play into an item's flavour, and it's clear that two people will never get the same flavour from a dish. After all, as Aristotle said, taste is on the tongue of the beholder. Well, that's not quite true about Aristotle, but in 350 BC he did come up with the idea of four basic tastes. He said that sweet and bitter could be modified by sour and salty, and that idea went unchallenged for more than 2,000 years. It was in 1908 that the fifth basic taste, umami, was discovered by Japanese scientist Kikune Akita. It literally means pleasant taste, although we generally call it savoury. But why stop at five? There is mounting evidence for other types of fundamental taste. Researchers have suggested some sort of metal taste. Blood, for example, tastes metallic. And some cultures garnish dishes with gold or silver foil. However, whether this is a separate taste or a side effect of generating a very small electric current is not clear. There is also evidence that, in rodents at least, they have a taste for calcium, particularly when it's in vegetables like spinach rather than in milk, when it's bound to fat. Ah, fat! The evidence that fat is a sixth basic taste is far stronger. You can certainly feel if a dish is fatty. You get a smooth, oily sensation on the tongue, but can we actually taste it? Researchers have identified a gene, CD36, that seems to correlate with the ability to detect fatty acids. But until scientists find receptors for these tastes, we're stuck at five. So how do we taste? A lot of people will be familiar with the tongue map with different regions. Sugar at the tip, you probably learnt it at school. Well, it's wrong. We can trace the idea back to a mistranslation of a paper published in 1901 in German, which was a study into the sensitivity of the different regions of the tongue, not into its ability to detect tastes. but the idea has been weirdly persistent, despite a few obvious flaws. It doesn't take much personal experimentation to realise that the tip of the tongue can detect sour or bitter as well. And where, for example, is umami in this map? The truth is that all tastes can be detected by all of the tongue, although some regions might be more sensitive than others, and there is a notable lack of specificity. Here's something to try in the comfort of your own home. Take a drink of milk, then look in a mirror and poke your tongue out. Rising out of the milky residue are hundreds of small pink bumps, mostly on the front half of your tongue. They are papilla. Specifically, the ones you're seeing are fungiform papilla, as they look like little mushrooms. By the way, a word of warning, never do a Google image search for tongue papilla. It's disgusting. In fact, you have four sorts of papilla on your tongue. In amongst the fungiform papilla, a filiform papilla, which detects the texture of food. Along the side of your tongue, a foliate papilla. And if you stick your tongue right out, at the very back is an inverted V of larger papilla called circumvallate. All of these papilla, except the texture sense in filiform, contain taste buds. These are onion-like bundles of up to 100 cells. Within this mass of cells, there are ones that carry taste receptors and as such are specific for one type of taste. As I hinted earlier, the definitive proof that the tongue can detect certain tastes only comes when we finally find a receptor. And it wasn't until quite recently that the taste receptors were revealed. A team led by two US researchers, Charles Zucker, whose name, incidentally, is very close to the German word for sugar, and Nicholas Reiber, found the first bitter receptor in 2000. Then they found the sweet receptor in 2001, umami 2002, sour 2006, and salty in 2010. As a bonus, they found a receptor for carbon dioxide linked to the sour receptor, indicating that it's more than just the feel of bubbles that gives champagne its fresh taste. Once these receptors are activated, the cells transmit their signals to the brain, and it's here, in the brain and not on the tongue, that we finally find our taste map. In 2011, Zucker and Reiber again published a paper in Science introducing the gustatopic map, showing that there are specific regions in the brain that respond to the different basic tastes, overturning the idea that taste sensations were distributed in the brain, determined only by emergent patterns. But the story doesn't end there. Taste receptors are found throughout the body. Thomas Finger from the Rocky Mountain Taste and Smell Centre has found bitter receptors in the human nose and in the airways. If a bitter compound stimulates these receptors, it will cause you to sneeze and cough, probably to stop anything toxic getting into your lungs. Finger has also found that the airways are home to sweet and umami receptors too, although what their purpose is remains unclear. Similarly, the presence of taste receptors in the stomach and bile duct are yet to be explained. What we do know is why there are taste receptors in the intestines. According to Robert Margulski at Monell Chemical Senses Centre, when these receptors detect glucose, they stimulate the release of hormones such as insulin to aid with digestion. One of the more surprising locations for taste receptors is on sperm. Specifically, according to Ingrid Birkhoff in Germany, human sperm carries an umami receptor. It appears to control the acrosome reaction, which is the start of the fertilisation process when a sperm meets the egg and disgorges its DNA into it. This raises an intriguing question. Do human ova taste of umami? This might all seem a bit weird. Why would we need to taste anything anywhere other than the mouth? Well, taste receptors are just chemical receptors. They are useful biological tools for detecting the presence of something in the environment and then stimulating a response. The evolution of taste provides some useful cues to further our understanding. The same taste receptors are found across the animal kingdom. It is an evolutionary advantage to be able to tell good food from bad. Essentially, sweet receptors detect carbohydrates, and umami detects protein, or rather its constituent parts, amino acids. These are two of the three basic macronutrients in our diet, the third being fat, which lends further weight to the idea that we probably have a separate fat detector. Bitter generally corresponds to danger. It's a sign of a toxin, although a lot of plants that are nutritious and not toxic still taste bitter, so our relationship with this taste is quite complex. Sour tastes usually indicate unripe or gone-off foods. Salt, and perhaps calcium, are essential minerals. But not all animals have the same range of taste receptors that we do. The evolution of taste is really a story of the evolution of the loss of taste. Like the loss of eyesight in cave-dwelling fish, if an animal's diet no longer depends on the ability to detect a certain taste, that animal might lose it. For example, Gary Beauchamp, also at the Monell Chemical Senses Centre, found that cats universally cannot taste sweet. From the tiniest tabby to the biggest lion, it seems that all cats share the same mutation in the gene that encodes the sweet receptor. Clearly a common ancestor switched to a protein-rich diet that rendered the need for a sweet receptor obsolete, and it's remained that way ever since. Beauchamp's team also looked at 12 other animals from the order Carnivora, which includes sea lions, otters and hyenas, and found sweet gene mutations in 7 of them. Dolphins can't taste sweet or umami, possibly because they swallow their food whole and have no need for taste at all. Pandas, with their bamboo-only diet, have lost their taste for umami. And vampire bats have no sweet receptor, although whether they have a metallic taste receptor is not yet established. But there's more to flavour than taste. Here's another fun experiment. Take a sweet, like a jelly bean or a Skittle. Hold your nose and pop it into your mouth. As you chew, you might get a sense of sweetness, but that's about it. Then release your nose. You will get a flooding of flavour, whether it's strawberry, apple, or, if you're eating Harry Potter beans, earthworm. Smell is essential for distinguishing flavours. Without it, an apple tastes the same as a potato, and other senses are important too. Charles Spence at Oxford University has experimented with sound. He found that people rated crisps as being fresher and, well, crispier, if they were played the sound of crunching as they ate them. David Gall from Northwestern University found that people rated cheese as tasting sharper after they had played with angular shapes. And expectation is important too. Frederic Brochet at the University of Bordeaux gave 54 students 2 types of wine to rate, red and white. The students described the smell and taste of the red wine using words like cherry and chocolate and blackcurrant, while the white wines described as honey, lemon and banana. In fact, it was the same wine both times. The red wine was white wine with food colouring added. So, in conclusion, taste is more than your tongue. Flavours are more than taste, and more of your body is able to taste than you probably think. This is Michelle Grayson from Nature, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to 4 years worth of archives. Yes, I believe this is the 4th anniversary show. We're doing things a bit low-key this year. We're doing things a bit low-key this year because 4's a bit of a weird number to celebrate, isn't it? You can find all of our archives at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, if you're into those sorts of things. And whilst there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation, or better still, offer me a job and pay me to do things. I'd like to do writing and podcasting, maybe. Maybe you can employ me to create content, if we can put it in such a mercenary way. You can find links to my CV and all the donation links at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, Lucy Abel, Mark Thompson, Layla Johnston, Shell Grayson, Alex Fitch, and me, James O'Malley. With additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. A sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Mrs. Goggins, have you heard the news?
Oh yes, Postman Pat. Just 1 year until the Scottish referendum and we can kick you Sassenachs back across the border.
I don't know why you moved to Greendale, Mrs. Goggins. I've never known a more racist old woman. No, the news is about the postal service. The government are privatising it.
But surely that won't affect us in Greendale, will it, Pat?
Well, Vince Cable says it won't change the universal service obligation.
What's that?
I think it's something to do with making sure that people are out before knocking and leaving a card saying we're trying to deliver a parcel. Or something to do with leaving elastic bands on doorsteps.
Well, that Vince Cable sounds a right nasty piece of work. Even Thatcher said she had not seen the Queen's Head privatised.
Well, she was true to her word. It's a Wetherspoons now.
Don't I just know it? After celebrating Andy Murray's win earlier in the year, I discovered that Jaeger bombs taste exactly the same coming up as they do going down.
That's good to know. Mrs. Goggins, we need a plan to save our postal service.
Well, you say that as if it's bad news, Pat. I mean, privatisation can work. I mean, look at the rail service, British Telecom, parts of the National Health... Oh, dear, yes, I do see what you mean.
Shares are being floated next week. It's going to end up with the profitable areas being deliverable and the more out-of-reach places like Greendale taking a back seat.
Is that right? So you mean, as a village dweller, I won't wake up every morning to charity begging letters, pizza delivery leaflets, replacement window adverts and opportunities to take high-interest credit cards clogging up my welcome mat?
Well, there is more to it than just that.
Well, sign me up, Pat. It's just one more nail in the coffin of the UK service industry. All you soft lefty do-gooders who want things to stay the same, you all need a damn good lick of the cat.
Oh, I get that, Mrs. Goggins. Jess loves it when I rub anchovy paste onto me...